95.7 Ben FM presents Her Story with Kathy Romano.
Good morning and welcome to Her Story. I'm Kathy Romano. Today's guest is the author of From Plane to Plane, My Mennonite Childhood, A National Scandal and an Unconventional Soar to Freedom. Growing up in the Reformed Mennonite Church, Patty Bear was taught that women were to be silent, submissive, and obedient, and couldn't hold positions of power. Her story of escaping the world of the plain people of Pennsylvania after a scandal her father initiated that captured the nation's attention more than a decade ago is chronicled in her book. Patty, thanks for joining me today to share your story.
Oh, it's a pleasure.
So let's start from the beginning. Tell me about your childhood and growing up in the Mennonite Church.
Yeah, sure. So the Plain People are the Amish and the Old Order Mennonites in Pennsylvania. And I grew up as part of a sect of the Old Order Mennonites. And everybody I knew was in this church. We had a rather insular society. And the women all wore the same uniform, these long, dark dresses, black bonnets, white caps. And as women, there was this segregation. We sat on different sides of the church, and we were trained that we had a role that was to be subservient and silent and submissive. So at 8 years old, I expected that this is the life that I would grow into. And to be honest, it was the only life at that point that I really wanted. I was eager to join. And at 8 years old, though, my father got excommunicated and shunned, and this upended everything and changed the entire trajectory of my life.
Shunned from the community?
Yes. So they practice shunning, and the way we grew up is while you're raised in this culture and you're indoctrinated in it, you don't officially join the church until you decide to do so. But then once you decide to do so, you can't ever leave. If you get kicked out or if you decide, hey, this isn't for me anymore, you get excommunicated and you get shunned. And shunned is an organized social ostracism. So, and it's pretty severe, you know, in cultures like us, because we kept ourselves apart from other people who, you know, the idea was that they were worldly and they might corrupt us. And so, you know, we were friendly and we did business with other people, but we interacted in our own community, and we were only allowed to marry in our own community, and we only had friends in our own community. So pretty severe when all of your relatives are in this community to be shunned, and that meant you couldn't eat with them, you couldn't do business with them, and you couldn't do the traditional greeting, which was the kiss of peace.
What was the scandal behind what happened with your father?
Our culture was an authoritarian culture, as you know, as you can get from these background information. And my father always chafed at this. Like he wanted to ask questions of the ministers. He questioned some of the things that they did. And he had been excommunicated once before in 1964 and over these arcane issues. And they kicked out my mother at the same time so there wouldn't cause problems between them. And then in 1972, he raised another, it was just this minor issue really, and he wouldn't let it go. And so they kicked him out for railing. But what made the national news was that he then turned the story into that the church had taken away essentially his property, you know, and that my mother and his children were property. And so while he objected to the church's demand for absolute loyalty and blind obedience, he didn't seem to register that that was the same thing he was asking of us. And so he became more and more enraged. He became violent, and he kind of went berserk. And as he did this, he expected that no matter how badly he behaved, we should give him respect and loyalty and love. And, you know, of course, that's just not possible with abuse. And we ended up eventually fleeing our farm, this farm that we grew up on and just loved.
To get away from your father?
Yeah, yeah. So we ended up living on the run from him. For 10 years until I left home. And it was a story that was hidden from the public. So there was this very public story where my father, as most abusers do, paint a story where they are the real victim. And so it was this exotic story, and it played well in the press. And he was in the news for almost 10 years. He was on the front page of the New York Times. He was in the Washington Post several times, People Magazine. He was on Good Morning America, and he was on Canadian newspapers and television. So, you know, on the outside, there's this story about this wronged man, but behind the scenes, we're living on the run from him, you know, terrorized by him. He kidnapped my sister, he kidnapped my brother, things like that, that, you know, we just lived in this hypervigilant state for many years that the public had no idea what was really going on.
Were you scared of him?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, because you never knew what he would do. And he was, you know, he was violent towards my mother, and he just was very unpredictable. So we fled our home many times. You know, one time he had decided that it's time for us to come back to the farm. And so he showed up at our house just before Christmas, the house that we had moved to after we left, and had hidden from him initially, you know, attempted to, and he hired a detective to find us. But he showed up at this house with either sledgehammer or an axe and knocked in the front door. And then he came in and took away all of our clothing and furniture and even our school books. So we ended up having to spend Christmas in the church nursing home, and then we couldn't go back to school after Christmas because we didn't have clothes or books. And that was just one of the many examples of disparity between the public image and the private image.
So at this point, were you still in the community? Were you still involved with the Mennonite church?
So my mother's still in the church. We're all going to church. We're all still a part of this. But I begin to realize by the time I'm in sixth grade that I begin to make these connections between what my mother expected of her life, you know, this public image and this private image. And by sixth grade, I determined that I am not going to have my mother's life. I'm going to be financially independent. I don't have any idea how I'm going to do that, but I'm determined I'm going to have something different. And so out of that, I call it sort of a trail of breadcrumbs, and I always like to come back to Joseph Campbell's quote. He says, follow your bliss and doors will open where there were only walls. And so there were these things that opened, and they weren't really blissful, but they were a path. In fifth grade, we had to take jobs to support ourselves because my father wasn't. And literally punching a time clock. And then I won a race in eighth grade track and field day, and I got recruited into varsity sports in high school, which was completely unknown for our background. So as a result of this getting sort of catapulted out of this world on the farm and everything we knew, they enter a new environment, like new things come up from the depths. So I end up running cross country and track and getting varsity letters. And the other thing from this background is that higher education is discouraged because it might lead you away from the truth. It was especially discouraged by my father. He didn't want any of his children going to college. He was adamant about that. But I had decided that if I was going to be financially independent, like really financially independent, I should probably go to college. And my oldest brother, who was a very independent thinker, very smart, very curious, he somehow knew how the world worked. And I told him this, and he said, I told him I wanted to go to college. And he said, well, he said, you need to take 4 years of math and science and 3 years of a language, and you should take the hardest classes you can take, the honors courses and the advanced placement courses. So I don't know any better. I just, you know, follow his lead and do exactly what he tells me to do. And then in 10th grade, he gets another bright idea. And by this time, he's graduated from high school. And of course, we all had jobs. We'd had jobs forever. He started taking flying lessons. So he talks me into it. And I'm like, why would I want to take flying lessons? You know, I don't have any money and it didn't interest me. But he was very persuasive. He paid for my first lesson and he paid for my logbook. So I go and I do it, and I don't particularly like it. You know, I don't have a driver's license yet. I'm scared I'm going to crash, and I got airsick. But I decided I would solo, which was like 10 hours, 10 flights. And then once I got to solo, I was like, well, I guess I'll get my, you know, my private pilot's license too. You know, from having been in the news for so long, we had people that had such contempt for us, you know, in the public. They would send letters to my mother and to us children because they believed my father's story and tell us what terrible people we were. Flying was something that was a positive way of being known. It was something different, and that felt good. And so I didn't expect it to go anywhere. You know, that was in 1980, and there were very, very few women in aviation. I never occurred to me to do that as a career. But what came out of that was there was this announcement one day in school about the Air Force Academy, and we came from a pacifist background. So I didn't know what that was. Had no idea.
You really weren't allowed, or they didn't allow you to serve in the military, right? It was strictly forbidden for women.
That's exactly right. Not just for women, for the men as well.
Oh, okay. So for everyone.
Yeah, for everyone. Nobody was allowed to serve in the military. We weren't allowed to vote. We weren't allowed to press charges in court. So, like, if somebody stole from us, we couldn't press charges.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, you couldn't go to the law for anything.
So, real quick, let me. I just want to ask you something. I just want to go back before you go into your military background. So, you decided that you didn't want to be a part of this life, that you weren't going to follow in your mother's footsteps. Was that okay? You are able to make that decision. Was that okay that you were not going to do that? And did you still have communication with your mother and other people in the community?
Yes, I did. And, you know, I didn't say that out loud. It was something that it was an internal vow. I just looked at these, you know, one day I had this moment of looking at these breads that my mother was making and selling on market, these tiny little breads, and thinking, how on earth is that ever going to support us? And I just made a silent vow. I was not going to do that. So, yeah, I was living with my mom. We were still in the community, still went to church all the time.
But I'm saying once they found out that that was your choice, are you then shunned or are you still able to have a relationship with your mother and other people in the community?
Oh, gotcha. Yeah, so the way it worked is if you didn't join, you weren't shunned. But once you joined, then if you decided to leave, if you rejected them, then you were excommunicated and shunned. So I had never officially joined, and so you're like anybody else in the world.
Okay.
You know, you don't have close ties with them, but you're not shunned.
Got it. Okay. So then talk a little bit about your new life that you created for yourself and entering the military and all of that.
So out of the blue, this announcement happens at school. You know, like I said, I don't know what the Air Force Academy is, have no idea, but it just, I'm like, oh, that sounds like it has something to do with flying. So I don't have anything else to do the next period. So I walk in and listen to what this cadet says. We didn't have any money, so I knew I was going to have to go to college on my own. And so this cadet, he says, it's, you know, hard to get into. It's free and they pay you $487 a month. And I was like, holy smokes, you know, this is my holy grail. I go through the process of getting the nominations from representative or senator and the whole, you know, long application process. I got to the Air Force Academy in 1982 when the third class of women after they were admitted to the service academies, the third class had just graduated. So it was pretty early on in that whole process. I graduated from the Air Force Academy and I became an Air Force pilot and I served as an aircraft commander in the first Gulf War and then got hired by a major airline, eventually became a 777 captain flying to a lot of international destinations, Europe, Asia, South America. Just a totally different
life.
Totally different trajectory than I ever expected.
Yeah. So what questions need to be asked to begin the process of breaking away from a situation that you were in? If there are other women that are in this situation, like what would you say to them?
So I would say that in these situations, what usually happens is there's some inciting event that causes you to question. When you're indoctrinated, as I was, questioning doesn't typically happen. But what I would say is that when it does come up, when a question does come up, ask, is this really true? Like, what else could be true? And reality test. So one of the things I talk about in the book is I had this experience early on. There was this heavy conditioning around women as a inferior sex, you know, second-class citizens. And I didn't think much about it. I heard this every week at church until I asked for the thing I wanted more than anything for my ninth birthday was an adult Bible. And when I began reading it, suddenly what I had heard was like seeing it in print really stood out for me. And I began asking the question, I was like, is this really true? Are men supposed to rule over us because they're superior? Like, are they smarter? Are they kinder? Are they wiser? And I looked around at the people I knew and I was like, I don't see that my brothers or my father or these people are smarter. They weren't in any way superior that I could see. And so it began to put that chink in the armor. And then the other thing that I would encourage people to ask is, what is change asking of me? Because there's always some kind of confrontation that comes up for us, and we can get stuck thinking that other people are to change. But sometimes that change is it's time to speak up, or it's time to leave, or it's time to chart a new path. But change is always asking something of us. Disruption, something about our past life, there's some illusion to confront, sometimes there's a lie to unveil, and sometimes there's just you know, it's asking something of us.
You mentioned lies, even, you know, not just your community, but I mean, I remember a time in my life when I realized what my mother was telling me and teaching me was really just her opinion. It wasn't a fact.
Yeah. Yes, that's exactly right. And the thing is that when it gets repeated often enough, you believe it's a fact. And when everybody around you is echoing this, it's very hard to break away because you think, well, everybody else and all these people that I respect and these people that care about me and who are charged with either in some kind of authority position or they're charged with taking care of me, they believe this. So am I the crazy one? But that process of questioning, of being curious, and I always call it navigating by curiosity. If you can navigate by curiosity and kind of test things against reality, then there's that sense of finding your own inner compass. And I think that's so important, is developing your own perception of what is actually true.
And all of this you touch on in the book.
Yeah. So what I did is I wanted to write the book as an illustration of what it looks like, this very deceptive, A, the indoctrination that I grew up with and coming out of that, what that looks like and how, you know, we often think these things are like an overnight change. But for me, it was 10 years. And you go back and forth. And at one point, well into the process, I think I was in 10th or 11th grade, I had decided, oh, I guess I'll join the church because I could see my mom was lonely. And so I was going to sacrifice myself, right? But I decided I would procrastinate for a year. I was like, okay, I'll join for her, but I'm going to put it off for a year. And then eventually I decided no. So I do, I tell that story of, you know, the uneven path out of indoctrination and into your own power, your own sense of your inner compass. And I wanted it to be an illustration of what this indoctrination, and in my father's case, gaslighting, what it looks like from the outside and what it looks like from the inside. So that, A, hopefully it's a good story, but B, people can relate it to their own life as well.
As you got older and you started to live your own life, did you have a relationship with your father?
Yeah, I did. You know, so relationship is kind of a strange word because with my father, it was always a one-way relationship. That's kind of the nature of the role of an authoritarian, right? So it's one way. It's a one-way street. So my relationship with my father was, he would have these long monologues about his grievances, and I would listen to him for a long time because I thought I was being compassionate. You know, I thought he needed affection, and I thought it was a way to show love to him, but I didn't realize how much it was taking out of me. And then I eventually began to set boundaries, because that's the other thing. As a woman in those cultures, you're not really allowed to have boundaries. And so I had to learn that. And that was, you know, like building muscles.
And how did he take that, you setting the boundaries?
Oh, not well. Not well at all. He would blow up. You know, it just infuriated him. And, you know, I come to this thing, though. I wished that, not that it would necessarily have made a difference for him, but I sort of wish I'd stood up to him before and said, listen, you're responsible for your behavior. You know, he blamed his bad behavior on everybody else. And I wish I'd just said kindly but firmly, you're responsible for your behavior. I think that that would have been the best thing for him. Nobody set limits on him. The courts didn't. The newspaper media coverage was very sympathetic. The public fell for this. He got acquitted of a crime that he admitted he committed in broad daylight with a lot of witnesses, and then he admitted before a jury that he had planned for days. And they let him off because they felt sorry for him. And I think that setting boundaries for these people is healing for them as well as for their victims, because they keep getting away with this behavior. He ruined all of his relationships with his wife, with his children, because of his behavior. And so perhaps if earlier he had boundaries that were set kindly but firmly, maybe he could have course corrected. I don't know. But I certainly know that my enabling of him, I don't think in the end it served either him or myself.
Where can people get your book, Patty?
So they can find it anywhere online. It's available for pre-order now, and it's available on Amazon.com, BarnesandNoble.com, Indie Books, Powell's, Books a Million.
Anywhere books are sold.
Anywhere books are sold online. You got it.
And before you go, if you could give one bit of advice to the listeners, anything at all, what would you say?
One bit of advice. What I would say is that these dark passages in life where your life is destroyed, that are messy and they're painful, they offer something vital. Through all of the chaos, there's some radical clarity that's being offered to you. And if you can kind of hold that in mind and look for what is the point of all this, there's something really valuable that comes out of that. It creates a phoenix point and a new life arises on the ashes of the old.
Patty, thank you so much for joining me today.
Thank you so much for having me. It was a pleasure.
If you're interested in reading Patty's book, it will be available on February 23rd. However, it is available now to pre-order anywhere books are sold. And the name of Patty's book, again, is From Plain to Plain, My Mennonite Childhood, A National Scandal, and An Unconventional Soar to Freedom. If you missed any part of Patty's interview, you can go to our website. It's 957benfm.com. On the left-hand side, you'll see shows. You click Her Story, and all of my episodes will be listed right there. And Patty's episode will be posted on Monday morning. Thanks again for joining me today. I'm Kathy Romano. Enjoy the rest of your Sunday.
This has been Her Story with Kathy Romano. Her Story is produced by WBEN-FM in Philadelphia and airs weekly or on demand on your mobile device. Listen or subscribe at 957benfm.com.
BackstageCountry.com, your online home for all things country music. Picking five of Carrie Underwood's best music videos was no easy task, but after some debate, we landed on five we believe rise to the top. Did Carrie's 2014 hit Something in the Water make our top five? Find out when you text Carrie to 45911 and scroll through the list on BackstageCountry.com. Text Carrie to 45911 to get your eyes on our favorite Carrie Underwood music videos.